You're listening to World Oil's Deep Dive, where you'll get to know the authors of technical articles in World Oil magazine and learn more about their company's technology and how it's shaping our industry. Now, here's your host, Jim Watkins.
All right, we're here today with Earl Koski Jr., and we're going to talk about the effect the coronavirus has had on the drilling part of our industry. And Earl is uniquely qualified to talk about that because he's got quite a history. Earl, well, first, welcome to the show. And then second, why don't you tell us about your family history with drilling?
Yep, I'm glad to be here. You know, we're still trying to make a living. We've been trying to make a living in this business since 1916. That's when my grandfather broke out working as a mule skinner for the fellas that built the old standard derricks, standard wood derricks for cable tool rigs and such. He ended up being a cable tool driller, became a rotary driller, became a tool pusher, drilling superintendent, and he didn't retire. He worked until they made him quit. And it really made him angry. You know, he was like 72 or something when they finally said, you know, we just need to have you stop working.
Did you ever play that song around that house, the Mule Skinner song?
No, we didn't. But there are some old oil field songs that my dad and my uncles know that you don't hear about very often these days.
Well, that's quite a history. And so how did that come down then? How did you get into it?
My father and his brothers all grew up around rigs. And in fact, I know my one uncle and my dad were making connections when they were 11 and 12 years old. And dad used to talk about how the people in the oil field were the only ones that had money back then. And they'd come in and go out on the weekends. They'd go out with a freshly pressed pair of khakis and a clean silver hard hat. And they were the big shots. So that's what he wanted to do growing up. And he did the same thing, roughnecked, drilling, tool pusher, drilling superintendent. He worked both onshore in lots of different places. While we were growing up in the oil field, we lived in San Angelo, Texas, Farmington, New Mexico, Scottsbluff, Nebraska, Fort Morgan, Colorado, and finally settled in North Louisiana. And when I graduated from high school, that's where I was based out of. My own experience, graduated in 70, and I had a pretty good scholarship at LSU, but I was coming from a small town in North Louisiana, and LSU just absolutely overwhelmed me. I had no idea what I was getting into. And man, you know, well, it's LSU. There you go. So I lost my really good scholarship after my freshman year, and then I got the most valuable scholarship of all, the roughnecking scholarship. I was able to hire on as a worm the summer of 71 and ended up working first as a lead tong, backup tong, finally derrick man, and worked derrick man most of the time, working summers, Christmas breaks, and I actually enjoyed roughnecking and being on rigs so much that I left school one semester and worked and went back to school after that one semester break. And school wasn't any more interesting than it was before, so I took off a second time and ended up being off for a year. But at the time that I left, I didn't know if I'd ever go back to college or not. They were starting to break me up, making connections and stuff, and I realized, you know, I really wanted to do more than just that. So I went back, finished up my degree, bachelor's degree in physics, minor in English, and roughnecking to pay for it all. So that was my combination.
Wow, that's quite an education, yeah?
Well, it was good for me. When I graduated, the best job I could find was in the bit business, security rock bits. I was area field product evaluation engineer for the Rocky Mountains based out of Casper, Wyoming. And I did that for about 2 years. And then got recruited by Christensen Diamond Products to go to their Diamond Technology Center in Salt Lake because they had this new thing coming along called PDC bits. And I thought, well, you know, roller cone bits have been around a long time. This PDC is new technology, looks interesting. And so in 1979, I got started in the PDC bit business. And as is often the case with all of us in our careers, a couple of those early decisions end up setting your path for a long time going forward.
And so you've been in the bits business ever since, right? You have a company called Polydiamond right now, right?
Yes, Polydiamond is my consulting company. I've been through so many mergers. In fact, as things have gone, I've ended up working for all four of the big four bit companies and two or three of the second tier bit companies. and then have also consulted for one, principally for one company in China for 7 years, and then another company in China for just 1 year, and really have gone through the bit side from the time I started with Christensen Drill Bits all the way up until I was working at Geodiamond in 96. So that was about 18 years. In 96 at Geodiamond at Smith, I switched over to working with Mega Diamond in the PDC actual side with developing other applications for Diamond. So 96 is when I switched and started working on the Diamond side. And 96 up till now, 06, it's what's another, another 24 years in the PDC Diamond side. But my start was in the bit side. And the most valuable thing was I knew how to handle myself on a rig floor. Altogether, I think my roughnecking at Enderichmann was 2 years and 9 months spread out over my college career. And having that practical background on what's really going on the rig stood me in good stead through the rest of my career.
Oh, absolutely. That gives you the basis for everything else. But now with your consulting business and dealing on the Diamond side of bits, you kind of have a front row seat to the meltdown that's been happening, right?
Yes, actually, I have just done the chart for today. And on my computer screen in front of me, and I'm thinking you guys will have it posted there, I'm actually looking at the meltdown in a graph in a chart right here in live and living color.
Yeah.
The previous record low on May 20th and 27th of 2016 was 404 rigs running total. As of today, we dropped to 408 rigs. We're only 4 rigs away from tying or beating the previous all-time record low. Well, we dropped 57 rigs this week. I got a feeling that we're not going to go from 57 rigs this week to only 3 rigs down next week. So I'm thinking next week we will be setting a new all-time record low. And this isn't just a record for the 60s or 80s or 90s. All the way back to the 1860s, when the oil industry was invented in Pennsylvania, there were more rigs running back then than this now ever. So this is a record low since the oil industry started 160-something years ago.
That's just insane. Let's back it up a little bit, Earl, because you have an e-newsletter where every week you chart the Baker Hughes numbers for the rig count, right?
Right.
And you show that over different lengths of time. Now, why did you start doing that?
I was consulting for a company in China starting in 2010. And, you know, the first thing that we worked on was to get them with a really good quality test lab. We made a lot of progress in a lot of areas. But in 2014, when we were really focusing on starting to bring them to the U.S. market, OPEC made this announcement in November that said they were no longer going to cut their pricing or their production to save oil field pricing. Well, that was the same thing they did in 1986. And in 86, I took on an assignment to set up a PDC drill bit plant in Argentina. And then OPEC said, well, we're just going to pump. We're tired of everybody else cheating and expecting us to make up the difference. So they threw open the pumps. And when I went to Argentina, when they approved the project, there were like 117 or 120 rigs running in Argentina. 6 months later, which is the amount of time it takes to get something done, when I landed in country with my family, the rig count was down to 35 rigs.
Ouch.
Well, as we've all seen in our careers, timing is everything. So no matter how hard we worked, we set up a repair facility, we were getting some record runs and such, but the overall conditions in the 86, 87 was such that we couldn't be successful with this startup. So in 2015 and 16, early in 2015, when I saw that OPEC was doing the same thing again as they did in 86, I knew that the fellows in China had never seen anything like this before. And so I started sending them historical information, articles about what happened in the past, and explaining, as we get to say in Texas, what we were fixing to see. Because it was fixing to be bad, and I knew it was going to be bad. Now, the thing was, nobody knew it was going to be this bad. at the time, it's like nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. We were coming down off of a rig count high on November 21st, 2014. We were at 1,929 total rigs. And the rig count immediately started plummeting. It had one little kind of a pause for just a few weeks, and then it started plummeting again. And we went from 1,929 rigs down to, on May 20th and 27th of 2016, that record low of 404 rigs. I had some friends that read my newsletter, and they were curious as to how did this decline that we're in now compare with the one in 2014, 15, 16. And so I did one chart, and I looked at that. And then I had another friend, fellow that I've worked with a long time, Dan Scott, who's retired from Hughes Christensen, but was very strong in the SBE. And Dan said, well, how does this compare with the declines back in 82 and 86? Well, that's a good question. So I sat down and went to the Baker Hughes archives and pulled all the information back going to 1970. And I set up, and of course, you know, just the rig count drop in 1 week, there's a lot of variation there. So I decided, well, the rig count drop over a month, over a four-week interval, really tells you how steep the decline is. So I set up a filter, and I looked at all of the four-week periods beginning in February of 1970 to give me those first 4 weeks, and found the steepest four-week declines through all of the previous five drops. Well, the thing that I was surprised by is that this current drop has, on a percentage basis, the steepest drop of any of the previous drops. And the earlier ones were bigger, but they were also starting from a higher rig count. So I was very surprised when I saw that right now we're in the steepest decline on a percentage basis that's ever happened in the oil field. Well, I hate that we're setting these kind of records.
Yeah, yeah. These are not the kind of records you want to set, for sure. But when you're looking back at the charts, and by the way, for everybody who's listening, if you look in the show notes, you'll find a link to these charts and also a link to a place where you can subscribe to Earl's e-newsletter as well, which comes out weekly. And Earl, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's free, right?
Yes. I'm doing it because it's interesting and it's a conversation that we're having amongst ourselves. I get answers back and questions back from some of the people that read it. But mainly, I started it with the point of informing some of these people that didn't have the history in the business of, you know, what we're going to be living through going forward. And, you know, I sit here and I look at this chart that goes back to 70 and it's going up here to 2021. And that chart pretty much covers my entire life. I lived through every bit of this. Kind of a sobering thought.
That's like your career chart there. That's a scary looking chart to look at, though. I don't know. I'll
see that one. And you know, it's like a lot of things. In retrospect, things appear to be clear why they led from one thing to another. But with foresight, rarely is that the case. If we knew what was going to happen, we'd all be millionaires in the stock market. But we don't know what's going to happen next. And that's like in my text for this week's discussion and looking at the decline that started just 5 or 7 weeks ago, actually, I typified the current decline in the rig count as the Thelma and Louise trajectory.
Yeah, it is right off a cliff.
It looks like we drove off a cliff and we're headed to the bottom.
Yeah, it is not a pretty thing at all to see. But, you know, the interesting thing for me is that, okay, you know, when you're talking back in the early 1900s and the number of rigs they had running, well, you know, those are those old wooden derrick rigs and stuff. We've come a long way. And so now we have these really, really high performance rigs. We have pad drilling where one rig's doing a lot of stuff. So I think that percentage decline from the high recently really, really shows, you know, because you have to adjust the charts for that, right? You say, well, what, you know, rigs, you know, even 10 years ago aren't what they are today, right? And so when you see that adjustment and then you say, wait a second, after today's numbers, what was the percentage decrease? I mean, it had to be more than 30, 35% or something.
The efficiency of drilling, the progress that we've made with technology, in the bit business particularly, we often say that we've practically worked ourselves out of a job.
Yeah. No, that's a crazy thing, right? Is it the better that the bits get, the better that the download assemblies get, the better that the rigs get, That just means you need fewer of all of those to do the same job.
The last several years, I've been saying that after 160 years, we finally know how to drill. We've got laterals that you can drill down in like the Eagleford, one big bit to drill the surface hole. And a lot of times one bit will drill the curve and then drill out a 7,000 foot lateral, maybe two. Those bits are all rerunnable. And then you can repair them and rerun again. And the big bits that are drilling the surface hole can be run 10 or 12 times before they even need the first repair. When I first started working in the 80s, the South Texas bit records had 20, 25 bits on them. You know, you're having to trip for bits and you spend that much time tripping. You're taking 4 or 5 weeks to drill a well. We're drilling a well in like a fourth of the time, and we're using 3 bits spread out over 3 wells. And it's just mind-boggling. I mean, literally like 3 orders of magnitude greater efficiency in drilling. And then, of course, the progress with horizontal drilling, with ability to steer. PDC bits brought that along because you can't steer these long horizontal intervals with rolling cone cutter bits because of the bearing issue. And so everything has come together with all of our knowledge in steerable systems, downhole monitoring, the mud motors, the PDC bits. And the cutter technology is so much better than it has been in the 80s and 90s and so forth. Our understanding of bit hydraulics, of bit dynamics, we've just really, really shrunk the number of bits it takes and the number of wells it takes to produce what was the greatest oil production right up until last month in the history of the United States. With number one driller, number one producer of petroleum, oils and gases and so forth. And that's after supposedly the United States has been all drilled up.
Yeah,
we're just now actually getting really good at it just in time for this current disaster.
Well, this is the amazing thing for me because it's one of the things I really enjoy about this industry. You know, and I'm not technical. I'm tangentially attached to the industry because I work in media for the industry. But, you know, we're always coming up with better ways to do things, you know, and to see that progress and all the progress that was made and come to fruition that really allowed us to take that number one position in the world for producing. That was truly amazing. But now the real question is okay, at these prices, that doesn't work for us. But I guess the question is with all our knowledge and everything we've figured out for drilling these tight formations, are there other places in the world where we can export this knowledge and still keep making some money, maybe if we're not drilling as much as we were here in the States?
Well, yes. It's exactly the same thing as we've done time and time again. The United States invents the industry. The United States invents the new technology. And then it goes across the world.
But yeah, so now getting back to the percent decline, because I know a couple of weeks back we looked at it and it was like at what, a 31 and change percent decline, the biggest decline as a percent from
right.
the highs. But with this last week, did you run those numbers again? Do we know?
Yeah, this past 4 week period, the rig count dropped 36.1% in 4 weeks.
And previously, what was the largest drop percentage? 20-something?
The largest from a percentage basis in 1986. In a 4 week period, the rig count dropped 22.4%. Now it was starting at 1,773 rigs, and numerically it was 397 rigs they lost, basically almost 100 rigs a week for 4 weeks. But because they were starting at 1,773 rigs instead of 728 rigs, over 1,000 fewer, on a percentage basis, that was 22%, and now it was 36% here in the week just ending last Friday.
Right. And that was back in the day when you needed a lot more rigs. You know, I read things from time to time, but I think that the number that I saw thrown around was a modern rig today could replace 4 of those rigs from before, right?
Frankly, I think it's a lot more than 4.
Wow. Yeah, okay.
Because I always talk about, when I talk about it, it's from the point of view of the drilling business. And it's important to note that we are not in the oil business. We're in the drilling business. Oil companies are in the oil business. When we're done, they get the well, they frack it, they hook it up to a pipeline or a truck or a tank battery, and they produce and sell oil, and that's the oil industry. We go drill the hole for them, and from that standpoint, it's sort of like a farmer where we're the ones that plow the field, But then a farmer's business isn't plowing the field. It's planting and cultivating and harvesting the crops. So the drilling business is like the tail that's wagged by the oil industry dog. And as is previously seen, when things are bad and they start to get better, you know, go like 1 year, well, things are looking better, but it's still a little iffy. A second year, and the oil companies will begin to believe, well, it's true. Let's go ahead and budget for drilling next year. And they will pass the budget. And so to come back and recover, to come back and decide you're going to start drilling wells, it's a very slow process for them to come back and believe the future is going to finally be better. The amount of time it takes to stop drilling is the amount of time it takes to call your drilling superintendent and tell them, never mind bringing that rig out next week, we're not going to drill. And that's why we see this precipitous drop. I remember reading about one of the operators up in the DJ Basin. I won't name who it was. They had 19 rigs running, and the very week that this started to go down, they came back and said, we are shutting down 7 rigs immediately next week. We have about 10 rigs we're going to shut down, and we're going to go from 19 rigs to 3 rigs drilling. And they decided to do it right then, and that was their plan. We've got other people that have decided we're not going to drill anymore. They're letting everything go. And so that's why drilling gets whipsawed by this oil industry issues. Now, on the other hand, the oil industry has to deal with things like futures that go to minus $37 a barrel for the first time.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not saying that that makes the oil industry any better, but their problems and their situation is the nature of the oil industry. Our problems is we're in the drilling industry. You know, we've got 4 major bit companies. We got several second tier bit companies that are really good. There's even a number of small mom and pop bit companies. And if we only have 300 or 400 rigs running, who needs all these drill bits? It's going to be really tough. It's going to be a very tough thing. And it's not just drill bits. It's mud, it's pipe, it's every service that supports the drilling contractors in the drilling industry. So, you know, you look at this chart, it's a Thelma and Louise trajectory, and we all know how that ended for them.
Yeah, no, for sure. And that leads on to another thing. So let's talk about, hey, you know, when all this starts coming back, why do you need drillers and rigs and stuff to start building back up when you have, like, I didn't look at what the duck count was, but there's a whole bunch of drilled but uncompleted wells sitting around, right?
Yeah, you're going to look at your drilled and uncompleted. You know, that was actually the same thing we talked about a lot when we hit the bottom in 2016. The duck backlog had gotten so large then that it was looked at as something that's really going to be a problem for actual new wells to be drilled, because there's a lot of wells out there. All they're waiting is for them to bring on the frack crews and frack the wells and put them online. This is going to be the same thing again. Now, the one big difference is your big companies, they're actually retiring and scrapping close to half probably of the fracking horsepower based on some of the articles. I see that people follow that pretty well. And those crews, all those crews that they had out in West Texas, those boys aren't going to be around, and girls. And, you know, whatever they find to do somewhere else, it'll take some time before you can begin to attract the manpower as well as the equipment and resources for the business to recover. It's going to be tough for drilling to recover.
Yeah, you have a great story about that, right? About a great big guy who you had to lay off in a downturn. Tell me that story.
Yeah, when we went through a downturn, let's see, which one was it? I think it was the one at the end of 82 to 84. We had a really good district manager in Corpus Christi. He knew South Texas like the back of his hand. But drilling down there plummeted. We had to let him go. We tried to cover it with a couple of salesmen and stuff. Business turned around about a year later. And the VP for the southern region called the fellow up and says, listen, things are looking good. We were sorry we had to let you go. We want you to come back. We want you to come back and run South Texas for us. He said, listen, after I got let go, I got a job managing a bunch of fried chicken stores. I go home every day. I don't have to get out in the mud. I got fried chicken anytime I want it. And I'm making a little bit on the side. He says, I'll never go back to the oil industry. Fried chicken is too good a living. You know, that was a factual deal where you get out of this industry, and drilling gets into your blood and it gets under your skin, but you can only take so much of it before you realize, well, is this something good or is it just a rash that I need to get over?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And then especially with young people in their careers and stuff. You know, we're looking at the big crew change. They've been talking about the big crew change for quite a while. Well, actually, today's my 68th birthday. I'm right in the middle of being crew changed out. I'm like my granddad. I may want to go ahead and work until I'm 72. But one way or the other, a lot of the experience that's been around for a long time, this is going to kick a lot of that out, because the big outfits are not going to want to keep the highly experienced but highly paid people. Those people won't be there to call back next time. And you're going to have young people who are looking at the oil industry and they say, well, why would I want to get into this? And it's going to be hard to find people to bring back into not just the oil industry, let's be clear, the drilling industry. Because also the drilling industry, we're 24-hour-a-day business. You actually have to work hard. Customer service is so important. And if you've got to take 3 nozzles at 3 in the morning, 35 or 55 or 105 miles to get a bit run, you got to do it. A lot of people don't want to work that hard.
Yeah, it's a tough business. And, you know, I mean, historically, I think the industry has relied on the fact they throw money at the problem, right? So if, you know, you're paying some guy straight out of university 100,000 plus to work, you know, that's pretty attractive. But it's always interesting to me because, you know, I talk to a lot of guys who, you know, not super highly educated, but educated guys who are out working in the field, making big, big money. And when I talk to them, I'm always like, but you know, this doesn't last forever, right? I mean, hopefully you're, you know, socking some away for a rainy day, because rainy days always come in this business. You know, I think that's what our industry relies on, is young, inexperienced guys who are willing to go out and do that work because they're throwing big money at them. But in the end, you know, I mean, the first time they get burned, they're like, oh yeah, maybe next time I'll do that again. But the second time they get burned, they're just like, what? I don't want to do this anymore. This is crazy.
When I was in Casper, Wyoming, the things were going up so much. They were hiring guys mainly from like the coal mines and stuff like that, at least people who had experience with that kind of operation. And they had guys that maybe had only been in the oil field, had only been working for drilling rigs for maybe 18 months. The drillers, they hadn't even hardly seen anything yet, but they had to have the people. But then when things slowed up, that big money disappeared and they left. So it's exactly the thing that you're talking about there. It's going to be a hard recovery. And there's so much of the institutional knowledge and stuff that it's, you know, we're going to have to live with it and deal with it, but it's not going to be an easy thing to do.
Well, you know, Earl, since we started talking on this podcast, man, we've only been talking doom and gloom. We got highest percentage drop ever of rig counts. We got guys heading out the door because they don't like the industry anymore. So, you know, you got a lot more experience. Give me a bright spot in all this. Where is the bright spot?
Surprisingly, and I read a lot of different articles. There's articles that have just come out in the last few days that are saying it looks like demand destruction may recover sooner than anyone would have expected. They're talking about China being open for business, but of course the consumer side is still slow. And the International Energy Association prepared a report just in April where they projected that supply-demand imbalance could actually get back to being balanced before the end of this year, much faster than I would have thought. But they had a very interesting discussion on why they thought that could be the case. So, you know, right now sitting here, you couldn't predict the future that things will come back pretty quick, but things could come back surprisingly quick.
Wait, Earl. So that's the good news, is by the end of the year, everybody can go back to work? Wait, you still got a lot of year left here.
If supply and demand get into mostly balance by the end of this year, that would actually be a really fast recovery. But just because oil got supply and demand get fixed doesn't mean that drilling will pick up. Supply and demand getting balanced is still going to be at a much lower demand level. You know, we were up to 100 million barrels a day. Maybe we're at 75 million barrels a day now. If we get up to 90 million barrels a day, that's a very good recovery, but it's still 10 or 11% less than where we were at just a few weeks ago. So there won't be a need for as much drilling. And we already have, like the Saudis have already shipped 43 million barrels of oil to the United States, hoping to kind of get in here and kill our horizontal drilling industry.
Yeah, I've seen those pictures. Have you seen those pictures? Like in Houston Chronicle last weekend, they were showing them stacked up off of California, all the tankers stacked up out there waiting to come in with no place to offload, basically.
Yep, and also using our tankers for storage. So, you know, by the middle of May, well, we still supposedly have about 90 million barrels of space left in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And I don't know whether how much of that is already leased to where it's not available. There's also storage facilities available overseas. But eventually, the thing that has to happen is for the operators to cut production and at the same time for the economy to get better and the demand to crawl back. But even if demand and supply get in balance, that doesn't mean that everybody's going to come back and say, let's pick up those 300 rigs we just laid down. We're going to crawl back.
So, yeah. So what's your guess? When do we start seeing a positive rig count? How long? Just a guess.
Well, I would think that we will probably overshoot how many rigs they need to cut. And if we gave ourselves 2 months of good news, let's say May, June, then I'd say maybe by the 4th of July, you'd come back and the rig count might actually hit a bottom and turn around. Or we might get to a bottom and meander, up 5 rigs, down 6 rigs, up 10 rigs, down 5 rigs. We might hit a bottom and meander for a while before we start a climb. But, you know, the way things are shaking out, I would think that by July sometime, we ought to be either meandering at a bottom and maybe have been at the bottom for some time and start to crawl back up to where you can see that the trajectory is upward.
Let's all hope so for the sake of our industry, you know.
All of our friends who need to work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's so many people that I know who've been laid off here. And we just need for that demand to get balanced and so people can get back to work. And yeah, so we can keep innovating because I'll tell you what, you know, I mean, usually the innovation comes from the small companies and gets snatched up by the big guys, right? And so if all the little guys go out of business and they don't see any profit in it, guess what? They're going to go innovate in some other industry. And we're going to be stuck with the technology we have for a while.
The PDC business is exactly an excellent example of what's called that disruptive technology. All four of the big bit companies all have PDC operations. Every single one of those was not organically developed by the big bit company. They were all other startups that the big companies bought because the big companies could not promote the new technology inside their organization, because at the same time, it would obsolete what they already had all this equipment to do. And that's been true in every industry, time and time again. Your disruptive technology always has to be promoted by new companies. And then the big guys end up buying those new companies as a defensive mechanism when they're dragged kicking and screaming into the future.
Right, exactly. Well, Earl, thanks for talking with us today. And, you know, I hope we'll have you back. Hopefully, I mean, I'm afraid next week we will see the all-time low, but we'll have you back on when we see a bottom turnout or something like that. And we can start talking about what might happen in the future and when we can get that turned around. But I won't hold you to that July, but I'm going to remember that. I won't hold you to it, but I'll remember it. Okay?
Oh, yeah. I usually put a little saying at the end of my weekly deals. One of the ones I've used several times: making predictions is exceptionally difficult, especially about the future. But
all right, Earl.
With that, maybe by July, we can come back and say, yeah, it looks like things are headed upward. Well, it's just like the old curse in Chinese: may you live in interesting times.
Oh, yeah. These are definitely, definitely interesting times. And for everybody who's out there listening, two things. Once again, you'll find in the show notes of this episode links to the charts that Earl updates every week, and also a link to where you can subscribe to his e-newsletter, get those in your inbox every week. And so I suggest you do that. It's quite interesting.
And then one other credit is Baker Hughes, Hughes Christensen, keeps that weekly rig count data that I've relied on for these charts, and they've been doing it for decades. So give them credit for actually doing the work to have the data for us to track that in our industry.
Yeah, no, they do an amazing job at that. All right, Earl, well, you take care and you have a great weekend. I don't know about anybody else anywhere else, but here in Houston, the stay-at-home order was officially lifted today. So now I guess we can go out, even though there's hardly anything open. I don't know where you'd go. But.
Well, I just heard today that within a week or so, all of the airlines are going to require everybody to wear masks. In my case, that's an upgrade. The less you can see of my face, the better.
All right, Earl. Take care. Thanks for being on the show. Appreciate it.
You bet. We'll talk to you all later.
Thanks for listening. Take a look at today's show notes for links we mentioned in the podcast. We enjoy your feedback, so if you have any questions or comments, email them to deepdive@worldoil.com. Check out worldoil.com for the best oil and gas industry technical articles and news. And join us next time for another Deep Dive with World Oil.